You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
In Shakespeare's play, Much Ado About Nothing, there is a, at the center of kind of the narrative of this play, that there is a woman named Hero and a handful of friends around her, and she falls in love with her man, Claudio. Claudio and her are engaged. They fall in love. They're to be married. And yet there is, as there always is in Shakespeare's plays, someone who hates everything that is good and beautiful and true. And so Don John, who is oftentimes for Shakespeare, they are bastard men. The bastard son decides that he hates everyone's joy. He hates everyone's. He wants to unravel and destroy everything good that is happening in this play that's unfolding and the stories of the people around him. And so he comes concocts a plan in which he deems to basically corrupt everyone's understanding of who Hero is. And so bringing Claudio to a window brags that a friend of his is actually going to be sleeping with Hero that night when actually Hero was nowhere near the scene and convinces Claudio that Hero is not the woman that he believed her to be, that Hero actually is a corrupt woman, that Claudio shouldn't trust her. And then on Claudio's wedding day, he exposes her as a fraud, actually maligns her name in front of everyone nearby. And at the center of this story, is that sound every week throws me off, and I always draw attention to it, but it's okay. It just sounds like things are bursting back there. At the center of Shakespeare's play, Much Ado About Nothing, in the midst of all the humor of this play, in the midst of the tragedy of this play, in the midst of all that's happening, is the central value of a person's name. And that when someone's name is maligned, when it's slandered, when we misunderstand and misconstrue the character of those around us, that some of the worst damage that can be done in the world is not actual sins against other people by hurting them or actually committing adultery or murdering someone. It's just reconstruing and twisting who people think they are. We come to the ninth commandment. We've been walking our way through the Ten Commandments, for those of you who are new, considering that these Ten Commandments are not just kind of an arbitrary list of moral or religious rules that God has set out for us, but actually contained in the Ten Commandments, in the brilliance of God, is actually an entire vision for how life is to be lived. And as we've walked through it, now arriving in this particular commandment, the ninth commandment, God begins to speak to how we're to use our mouths, how we're to use words. And we live in a world inundated with words in which people speak truth. People become masters at taking the truth and twisting it or coloring it or covering just parts of the truth while other parts of the truth are exposed. We live in a day and age in which everyone from the President of the United States to the news talks about fake news and how the truth is being maligned. And I can think of very few commandments outside of the ninth commandment that speaks so directly to the day and age in which we live. A commandment absolutely pertinent to understanding how we're to live as the people of God in the midst of the world. A commandment that addresses and speaks to what I think is one of the most fundamental places in which our culture is twisting in on itself and really pursuing self-destruction in a way that's horrific. To get there, we're going to go back to Ephesians chapter 4. We talked last week about how Paul in Ephesians chapter 4 is addressing, after coming out of the first three chapters, is addressing the people of God and saying, now, in light of the fact that you are a new person, a new man, a new community, here's how we're supposed to live in the world. And what he does is he begins to take the last commandments, particularly the last four commandments, and throwing them together, addressing and kind of describing the shape of a community's life in terms of those last four commandments. And central to that, central to his exposition of how we're to live is the ninth commandment. And so I want to I want us to get into Paul's mind a little bit before we actually look at what he has to say and ask the question that we ask every week, which is, what does this commandment actually address? I want you to get into Paul's mind for a second. For those of you who don't know Paul's story, Paul was a highly educated Jew who understood the law of God in and out. He had been trained kind of within the best schools of his day, mentored under some of the brightest minds of his day to think as clearly as he could about the law of God. And what it meant to study the law of God in the first century meant that you went back to the Old Testament. You went back to actually specifically to the text that we had read for us earlier, Exodus chapter 20. And you looked at those 10 commandments, examined those 10 commandments, and then worked your way through the rest of the Old Testament. And you perceive that largely kind of in the books surrounding Exodus, that what God was doing, what Moses was doing is there is expounding or applying the law that he'd laid out for us in Exodus chapter 20. So if you happen to read the Bible through in a year, and every year you get to Numbers and Leviticus, and even Deuteronomy to some extent, and you get there and you kind of groan, I want to tell you that's okay if you groan. I groan. And you get to those places in the Bible, and you're like, oh man, I got to read about diseases on tents, and like, how many times do you have to burn the tent if there's a disease, and who can walk into the tent and who can't, how many times they have to wash themselves. You begin to work your way through those parts of the Old Testament, and the way that you would have studied that in the first century, the way that Paul would have studied that in the first century is like case law. So you had the kind of propositional law within the Ten Commandments, like here's what God commands, and then the rest of the Old Testament was essentially case law. It was applying those Ten Commandments to specific areas, specific situations, situational applications of the law to different ways of living. And so when we encounter Paul, when you read him in the New Testament, the man that you're encountering is not just kind of this idealized philosopher who was really smart and knew how to kind of think up a new religion. That's oftentimes how he's cast in secular circles. We're actually dealing with, first and foremost, before we ever get to Jesus, before we ever get to kind of his articulation of the gospel, you're getting a man who spent years, decades, meditating on, thinking his way through the Ten Commandments. I mean, imagine that for a second. You've spent decades, and your job was to meditate on, think to the very bottom of, and then think about how do we apply, both individually and in society, everything that God has said in these Ten Commandments. That's who we're encountering when we come to Ephesians chapter 4. A man who loves the law of God, and loves it not sentimentally, not just emotionally, but loves it to the point that like he's dedicated his life to studying and understanding and applying it to every facet of reality. I was reading Psalm 119 this morning. Psalm 119 is this insanely long poem, actually an acrostic, a poem that declares that the psalm writer's deep love for the law of God. This psalm would have resonated with the very heart of Paul. This is how he saw the Bible. This is how he saw the scriptures. He didn't just go to commands like thou shalt not steal or bear false witness against your neighbor and try to kind of narrowly define it in a way that we could kind of check a box off a list. Now, what he saw in the law, what he loved about the law, as someone who was a student of it, who was being charged and trained with expounding the law to God's people, is he saw in it an entire framework for how all of life was to be lived. This is what his life was dedicated to. And then he has a vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus. And he's going to Damascus specifically to arrest Christians who he believes are kind of teaching contrary to the law of God, who are undermining the thing that Paul has dedicated his life to teaching and understanding and thinking about and applying. And on his road, on this road, traveling to Damascus to arrest this sect of Jews who he believes are maligning and kind of undermining what he sees to be the central reality in all of the universe about how to live your life. On the way there, he encounters and has a vision of Jesus. He tells us in Galatians that he sees Jesus. Luke records it as he hears a voice and a bright light and it blinds him. But on that road, he encounters with in the person of Jesus, not something new that kind of breaks the law, but the perfect interpretation of, the perfect application of, the one who perfectly embodies all that the law was. He will speak of Jesus as being the end of the law. Not the end of the law in the sense that the law ends and now something new begins, but the end of the law in that everything that the law aimed at finds its fulfillment in Jesus. So that Paul's whole point, what transformed with him on the road to Damascus, and we actually know from other writings that he actually in Galatians as well, that after this encounter with Jesus, he begins to preach, almost gets himself killed a few times because he's talking so great about Jesus, and then he actually goes and spends 3 years in the desert to kind of rethink his entire understanding of the world, rethink his entire understanding of the law in the light of the fact that Jesus actually is the Messiah, that Jesus actually is the fulfillment of the law. So that Paul would say, would be one who would say things like, if you want to know what it means that thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder, then you have to look to Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of that command. If you want to know the meaning of thou shalt not steal, then you have to actually ultimately, not just understand the case law of Leviticus, but you actually have to ultimately, supremely, go to Jesus. And you'll encounter in Jesus the perfect embodiment of what does it mean to live your life not stealing, but rather working diligently for the good and the flourishing of others, as we talked about last week. So then you get to Ephesians chapter 4. In the first three chapters, he's expounded a beautiful vision of the grace and the mercy of God. And now in the light of that, we're to live a certain way in the world. And as he describes what life in that community looks like, what life in this community should look like, which is his emphasis in chapter 4, it's startling to me how central that the life of our mouths is to that vision. Like, he doesn't spend a ton of time talking about money. He doesn't spend really any time talking about, well, much. He spends a little bit of time talking about what we should do when we get together for worship. But he comes back again and again and again, like a broken record, only expanding on it each time to how we're actually supposed to talk about one another and talk to one another. Have you ever considered that? I felt the weight this week of realizing how central it is to the Bible, and particularly to Paul in this chapter. As he's describing, hey, here's the most important things for you to think about as you try to form a community that's shaped around the work of Jesus and the glory and the beauty of God. How little time I actually spend thinking about how I should speak to you and to other people and to my family. How little time I actually spend like meditating on, thinking back, reviewing. Hey, when I said that, what were my motives in that? What would be the effect of saying that? How little time I spend, and we maybe spend as a community, emphasizing and meditating on and wrestling with how do we speak well? How do we speak in line with this command and what Paul says compared to how much time Paul spends thinking about it? It's central for him. It's absolutely central for him. And this is not just true of Paul. It's true of a place like James. James is most concerned about addressing like the most practical realities of how we live our life in this world. And one of the most memorable passages in all of the book of James is this text about the power of the tongue to actually set fire to the world. That who can tame it? Who can control the tongue? A word spoken here or there, and California burns to the ground. So as we come to the ninth commandment, and particularly Paul's application of the ninth commandment, as Paul understands how we're to live our life in the world, like, we're not talking about a small thing. We're talking about a massive thing. And we live in a culture in which words have multiplied, which means that the opportunities for sin or for faithfulness with regards to this command has multiplied greatly. So, taking Paul's text, what is this command actually speaking to? Well, the first thing to know about the way that the ninth commandment gets applied, particularly as it plays itself out through the rest of the Old Testament, is that the ninth commandment, it has a particular setting. Some commentators have taken the ninth commandment to mean, hey, don't lie. It's actually a far more complex commandment than that. It's not simply saying don't lie, although it's going to speak to the issue of truthfulness in the midst of speaking to other things, but it's primarily concerned, its primary framework in which it would have been originally heard has to do with a law court. That if you're called as a witness in a court of law, you're to speak truthfully, you're to speak honorably about your neighbor. So the fundamental concern of the ninth commandment is not just truth for the sake of truth. We're actually going to see that Paul is going to help us understand this a little bit better, and the Westminster Larger Catechism speaks to it, addresses the reality that truth can be used in really devastating and harmful ways to hurt people. No, the ninth commandment actually goes much, much deeper than that. It's actually primarily concerned with what are you doing with the name, the character, the perception of your neighbor? Are you speaking that which is true and faithful? Or are you maligning? Are you slandering? Are you corrupting how your neighbor is seen and perceived in the world? So the center of this command, please hear me, it's not saying just lie. It's actually very concerned with truthfulness. But oftentimes the ninth command gets reduced to, hey, don't lie. It's actually doing something fundamentally different than that. It's saying, no, don't slander, don't corrupt, don't actually malign the character of your neighbor in what you say. It also struck me in thinking about this, like how relational the Ten Commandments are. All of them are grounded and rooted and fulfilled in the fact that our lives are knit together. That's a central presupposition for Paul in Ephesians chapter 4, and it's there over and over and over again in the Ten Commandments. We talked about this last week, but I just have to bring it up again. He says, speak the truth to your neighbor because we are members of one another. The grounding for Paul as he applies the ninth commandment is that our lives are intertwined. We belong to one another. That there is a kind of, can I say healthy codependency? Maybe. Verdict's out. Jenny will tell me later. There's a kind of life that we're to live in which speaking the truth to one another, honoring one another, defending one another, caring for one another, using our words in a particular kind of way, that we should do that. And the reason you should do that is they're not an isolated individual and you're not an isolated individual, but actually your lives belong to one another. So that what you say, how you build up this person or destroy this person is not just an effect on them, but actually has all kinds of ramifications for the entirety of the community, including you. And as you walk through the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal is not primarily about you not violating some rule. At the end of the day, it actually begins to unravel the fabric of a community. But when you're not fulfilling the obligation that God's given you to do good work with your hands, with your life, that you might have something to share with others in this community. There's a kind of vision of life that permeates the Ten Commandments, that permeates Ephesians chapter 4, in which our lives are not our own, but rather we belong to one another. Our work belongs to other people. Our words belong to other people. So what does this command require then? So I just want to run through just a handful of phrases that Paul uses to try to get at the meaning of the ninth commandment. So in verse 15, he says, speak the truth in love. So I want you to see two things about this. One, speak the truth. So don't lie. Okay? In love. But there's a trajectory to it. In other words, you don't fulfill the ninth commandment simply by speaking what is true. And you don't fulfill the ninth commandment simply by doing something that's loving. You fulfill the ninth commandment by speaking the truth in the trajectory for the purpose of love. And then everything else he's going to say in chapter 4 about this, everything else we're going to look at, actually expands on these two ideas. So most basic to what the ninth commandment is telling us to do is don't lie to people. Don't color the truth. Don't twist the truth. Obviously don't say an untruth, but also don't take what is true and twist it in such a way with either a tone of voice or the context in which you say something that is true, such that it would be misunderstood and misperceived by people around you. And secondly, the goal of the words that you use is love. Not to tear down, not to destroy, not to expose, but to love. And love here is not defined primarily as kind of a feeling. So that's one of the things we're going to find as we work our way through our text. And as you try to look at even particularly Jesus as he does this, Jesus isn't really concerned about your feelings. And yet I think Jesus is always speaking the truth in love. Jesus has an odd habit of saying remarkably hurtful things. But everything he says is both true and directed by the call of love itself. So what else? How else does Paul expand this? Verse 25, if you jump down, he says, put away falsehood, but rather speak the truth with your neighbor. Put away this idea of falsehood is this false image, this false front, this false needing to be perceived in a certain way by your neighbor. Rather, put that away and speak the truth with your neighbor. And his reasoning for why, again, we already quoted it, but is because we are members of one another. That why would you falsely present who you are? Why would you falsely present the truth about you or the truth about the universe, the truth about the world when you actually belong to one another? You're actually knit together. So don't lie. Don't put on false presentations about who you are, about what the world is. Rather, speak the truth to your neighbor. And I think that absolutely means your real neighbors. And it absolutely means if you're married here, your spouse, and it absolutely means if you have children, your children, speak the truth to them. Speak the truth about who you are and about what the world is. Little personal story here. Like there was our family went through a really hard season about 3 years ago. It lasted longer than 3 years ago, but during that time, it was hard. Like it was a genuine struggle, and I'll just speak for me. Like to emotionally, like days were hard. I don't know if you've gone through seasons where it's hard to just like get out of bed and smile, but like that was a season. And there was this temptation, as Jenny and I kind of knew this season was going to be hard, it was going to be intense, it was relationally difficult with people outside of our family, it was emotionally hard within our family. There was this temptation to like try to present something false to our children. Like, hey, this everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine, like it's going to be okay. Partly because of a desire to say, hey, we don't want to put onto our children kind of this weighty anxiety that will kind of like leave them kind of wondering what the world is about. But in the end, and we sought counsel and said, hey, how do we kind of walk through this as a family, and how do we help our kids make it through this thing well? And the advice we were given is like, be honest with your kids. Speak honorably, speak truthfully, speak lovingly, speak in a way that holds high, kind of a high esteem of who Jesus is and the sovereignty of goodness of God. Be willing to confess your sins in the midst of all of that. And so we did. And so we'd have regular family meetings that would often end in tears and prayer. There was an honesty about what we did. There was the ability to share, hey, here's where we've struggled. Here's where we're struggling right now. But hey, we trust God in the middle of all this. We would try to speak as honorably as we could of the other people involved in it. And we'd even said from the front, like, hey, we're probably going to sin here. And we would often sin there. And then our children, particularly our very wise daughter, would perceptibly say, hey, like, that wasn't actually very honorable, what you said about that person. And the temptation was to try to present a kind of a falsehood to them. Like, we're fine, everything's fine. But like, those of you who have kids, like, kids are smart, right? They're like way smarter than you think they are. And the terrifying part about their brilliance is not that like they're all book smart, but they're all like insanely perceptive, right? Like, they know things are going on emotionally in the family, whether you talk about them or not. And so when you're not being honest, when you are presenting a falsehood, what you end up doing to your kids is they know something's wrong. You just leave them to kind of guess and try to figure it out. But we're called by Paul, in light of the ninth commandment, to live our life in such a way in the world that we're putting away falsehoods and we're speaking honestly. Now, that doesn't mean, particularly in a culture that we love to kind of gush and just say whatever it is that we feel, that doesn't mean that like you're allowed to sin with your mouth and just say whatever you think. You're still held accountable for your words. But as you speak what is true, put away falsehood. Don't put up a false front or wear a false mask. Verse 29, he says, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouth. Rather, what is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. So here Paul actually kind of expands on this idea that we're supposed to speak the truth in love. What does that mean? It means that your words, it's not just enough that they be true. They should be true and aimed at the giving of grace to those who are listening to you. That people would be built up. In other words, the goal of your speaking, all of your speaking, is that people around you would be filled up with greater measures of grace, greater measures of love, a greater vision of the goodness of God, a greater vision of what is true about the world, a greater vision of the kindness and the mercy of God, and not torn down, not corrupted. That the words of your mouth as you speak, let's say you are having a conversation with someone about someone else, that the aim of that conversation is never that there would be a vision of that person that's corrupted, but rather that there is this intention, this movement towards kind of honoring the name of other people. It's interesting, the Westminster Larger Catechism, as it expounds like what this command actually speaks to, what it demands of people who obey the ninth commandment, what it demands of all of us who live in the world, is this inclination, this kind of leaning towards, I want to cover over the sins of my neighbor, and I want to exalt the graces and the kindnesses of my neighbor. This means a certain way of living in the world, a certain way of speaking in the world, a certain posture towards your spouse, a certain posture towards your kids, a certain posture to the people around you that you don't really like very much, that doesn't lie, but goes out of its way to cover over their sins, to cover over the less than honorable parts of who they are, and to exalt, to hold up the graces that God has given them. The graces that they are in the world and to you, that holds up the beauty that God has instilled in them, the kindnesses that God has instilled in them. It is a posture that says, I want to fight for their name on their behalf. The larger catechism actually goes so far as to not imputing kind of broken and evil motives to people, fighting as hard as you can to assume the best about your neighbor, to assume their best intentions, to assume to see and to glory in and to honor that which is honorable in them, and as much as possible to cover over the things that you find not honorable or that aren't honorable. And it seems like our tendency is to do the opposite. We want to have conversations about people all the time in which we want to expose kind of the dishonorable parts of who they are, corrupting other people's understanding of these people, rather than an inclination to say, no, I want to cover those things over and hold up the glory, the goodness of this person as much as I possibly can. And as you walk through the Bible's like deeply concerned about protecting the honor, the name of other people. I was reflecting on Matthew 18 this week. And in Matthew 18, Jesus says, hey, if you catch someone in a sin, if someone is sinning, it doesn't say, hey, go kind of get clear with your neighbor or your friends or the church elders or a group of people from the church and try to figure out how you should address that sin. No, it says, if you see a sin, go directly to them and address it. And if they won't receive you, if they won't listen to you, if they don't have anything to do with you, then you go get, again, don't go have a conversation with that small group of people. Don't meet with a bunch of people in a coffee shop and discuss all the problems you have with them. No, it says go get one other person, and one other person who is a witness, and then the two of you go together and you talk to that person and you address the sin that you saw. And if they won't receive you, and by the way, the word there is not, if they don't just kind of take everything you say, the word for reception is if they won't engage meaningfully in the conversation, if they won't engage meaningfully in what's going on, doesn't mean they have to agree with you. It just means, are they willing to engage? If they won't receive you then, if they just dismiss your concerns offhand, right? That at that point, and only at that point, do you then go to the church, to the elders specifically, to the leadership of the church, and then bring them to bear on what's happening in that interaction. And that text gets rolled out oftentimes to talk about the role of church discipline, the meaning of church discipline. We'll actually talk a little bit in the spring about that as we talk about installing elders and pastors in our church. But actually, Jesus' main concern in Matthew 18 is to protect the name of the accused. There's an inclination in the Bible that says that we want to cover over as much as we can while speaking the truth. Again, this doesn't have to do with lying. Cover over the sins of others as much as we can and hold out the grace that's been given to them. At the heart of the ninth commandment, yes, is speaking the truth, but it's speaking the truth in love, aiming at the building up, the honor, the love, the integration of, the flourishing of those around us. This is the goal of our words. We live in a culture that has trained us not to live like that. Has trained us to treat words cheaply. So that anyone can say anything. Whether you're talking about the news, you're talking about your own individual relationships. But we live in a world that has utter disregard for the ninth commandment. And as such, we find ourselves in a world in which words are corrupted, in which I honestly can't even watch the news because I don't know what to trust and what to listen to. And some of you went home for Thanksgiving and you have family members that all they do is watch Fox, and some of you have family members that all they do is watch MSNBC or CNN or whatever the thing is, all of them claiming to speak truth. And here's the funny thing. Oftentimes they are. But it's truth that's been colored. It's truth that's been twisted. It's truth that's not aiming at building up. It's truth that's not aiming at love. It's truth that's not aiming at the honor of people and building up this community in God's grace and God's mercy and what is true. It's actually aimed at like political agendas and lustful desires and twisting and destroying other people's agendas so that my agenda can be fulfilled. We do the same thing in our lives. We use words cheaply, twisting, corrupting, maligning reputations and the lives of others. Why? For our own agenda. We oftentimes use words aggressively, but oftentimes we speak as cowards, refusing to name what is true because we want people to like us. And is that not just breaking the ninth commandment again for your own agenda? Oh, that God would birth here a community that is eager to speak what is true, but to speak what is true in love, that is eager to, when we encounter and walk together with brothers or sisters, and we just walking up close together, we see their sin, we see their junk, we see the places that in which they're broken and they don't know how to live life, and rather than exposing it, rather than whispering about it, rather than telling stories about it, man, our impulse, our desire is to cover those things over and to show honor to them over and over and over again, who are jealous for one another's names. But how do we become a community like that? Well, Paul says that Jesus is the end of the law. And one of the most beautiful things that Jesus has done, one of the deepest meanings of what the gospel is he has covered over all our shame. He has taken as a deep, deep concern of his your name, your character. The central sacrament of the church, the sign that you belong to God is baptism. This sign that we've been clothed in the righteousness of Jesus. That's both legally true in the sense that you stand before God, and rather than Jesus standing as a witness against you, rather than Jesus standing and maligning your character and exposing all of the things about you that are evil and wicked, no, he himself, with his blood, with his character, with his righteousness, covers that over on our behalf. Oh, when you realize that, that Christ, the perfect one, the holy one, the righteous one, that one of the very meanings and purposes of his life was to cover over our sin, to cover over our shame, and to present us to the Father, bearing not our name, but his. Doesn't that liberate us? Doesn't that call us into a kind of life where we mimic Jesus, covering over the shame of others, demonstrating, pointing to every honorable thing we can, wielding our words to give life as the words of Jesus are there to give life, speaking the truth, but always speaking the truth directed towards the end of love. That's the call of the gospel. Let's pray.